You are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me for our Throwback Tuesday episode, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Glad to have you listening in, whether this is your first time listening to Locked On Seahawks or you're a daily listener. Glad to have you tuning in for our jam-packed episode. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks, I want to take a step back. We've been covering this Russell Wilson trade chatter so much over the past few days, and we'll go back to it in this episode with Ross Jackson of Locked On Saints coming on for his thoughts on the Saints as a potential fit for Russell Wilson. But I want to take a step back because you look at the reason we're even at this point. Most of the reasons behind this are because of how the 2020 season finished. You had the discontent between Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll. The offensive line in the second half, they were banged up. They weren't playing as well. Brian Schottenheimer didn't make the adjustments against two deep coverages. Pete Carroll started meddling with the offense. All these different narratives out there that, quite frankly, I think all of them were factors in Seattle's offense struggling the way they did in the second half of the season. But this has been eating at you and I since that wild card loss to the Rams. There has been this other narrative out there, and I've seen some big media people that have been pushing this. Warren Sharp is one that was pushing the idea the Seahawks went back to being a run first, a run heavy team in the second half of the season. And you and I, just watching the film, thought that's not true. There is no way that is accurate. And now we can sit here and we can confirm that that narrative is a Pacific Northwest myth, nothing more.
Well, it takes on the life of Sasquatch and things like that. You know, just kind of builds up its own reputation. You know, that's the thing, Corbin. As you said, there were so many narratives that came out of Seattle's disappointing end to the 2020 season. You know, everybody focused in on Russell Wilson's accuracy. It's just vanished into thin air. Or, you know, the lack of the offensive line consistency. You know, as you mentioned, whether it be Pete Carroll, trying to, to push his weight around a little bit in terms of how Seattle was running their offense. Two other narratives that you didn't mention there that I think are legitimate as well, as are all of those, is just the level of competition changed significantly in the second half of the season. And Seattle's pass catchers as a whole, I thought, really kind of flattened off as well. DK Metcalf continued to have some absolutely spectacular performances. Tyler Lockett occasionally had some big time performances, but we never did see that third weapon really explode for Seattle the way that some of the other offenses have in the NFL. But when you really start taking a statistical look at the number of times that Russell Wilson dropped back and threw the ball, it really just shreds that whole theory that Seattle had suddenly gone, you know, back to the Chuck Knox and 3 yards in the cloud of a dust type of a offensive mentality. And so I know that you did some research on it. I'm curious to hear what your research kind of proved out over the course of the season.
Yeah, you just mentioned a couple other narratives that I think absolutely have some truth to them, especially the lack of a third target emerging. That's something we've talked about periodically, whether we're looking at last season in retrospect or free agency in the draft, the need to add a third weapon on the outside or at the tight end position, just a reliable third target that's an upgrade over what they had. But this idea that suddenly the coaching staff was like, you know what, Russell, yeah, you were just lighting it up the first half of the season, but we are going to completely shut down your restaurant. We're pulling you out of the kitchen. You're going to go back to handoff duty is complete BS. It never happened. Now, what makes this ironic is that you and I both know this. Pete Carroll was pushing this after they lost to the Buffalo Bills in week 9, which really was a season changer, in my opinion. That game and the game after, the road loss to the Rams. Russell Wilson had 7 turnovers in those games, and several of those picks, they weren't just bad luck interceptions. They were horrible decisions by Russell Wilson, throwing into double and triple coverage, throws he never should have made. Kind of what's gotten lost in all of this is a lot of people say, well, Pete Carroll ended up, you know, hindering Russell Wilson. He lost his confidence, whatnot. But why would you not be concerned a little bit after seeing some of those throws that Russell Wilson made in those two games? You had to rein him back a little bit, and they may have overcompensated. I think any smart head coach would have been like, look, we're not going to reel things back too much, but you can't make throws like that and expect us to win games against good teams on the road. They kept slinging the rock, though. They had over 36 dropbacks per game the last seven games of the regular season, Rob, and running backs and receivers had only 21 carries per game during that time. So we're talking less than 40% of the offensive plays. So if Pete Carroll was really meddling with the offense and took it over and Brian Schottenheimer wasn't calling the plays, I find that very hard to believe, because you and I both know if Pete Carroll is calling the offense, they are not running the ball at their running backs and receivers just 38% of the time. That is not happening, especially with the fact he kept telling reporters, we got to get that run game going, being a bit more balanced. That never came to fruition.
No, it really didn't. And that's the thing, is that you can look at this in every different statistical way that you'd like. You can believe whatever narrative that you'd like. When it all comes down to it, is that the Seahawks offense just basically stopped working nearly as efficiently as it was in the first half of the season. And that is not just in the passing game. It's in the running game as well. You know, Seattle was not running the ball as well in the second half of the season. They their inability to really control the line of scrimmage in the running game, of course, allowed the defense to be able to play that two deep safety look and to be able to kind of take away Seattle's deep shots in their offense, which have been such a huge part of their success on offense in the first half of the year, is Russell Wilson just being able to throw some of those picture perfect deep balls that really blew games wide open. It gets fans all excited. And when you go from being one of the best big play offenses in the NFL with your highlights basically taking over all the SportsCenter's top 10 to basically switching over in the second half of the year, where the only way that you could score a touchdown is if you happen to matriculate your way down the field on a 12 or 15 play, lengthy drive, then obviously your offense is not nearly as predictable, or is more predictable. And because of that, then it's a lot easier to defend. And so that's where we really saw Seattle's offense really struggle in the second half of the year. And so again, it's going to be relying on the Seahawks to be able to kind of improve in that area, to be able to find that third weapon and have a little bit more consistency along the offensive line. And that's going to be a huge challenge considering all of the lack of draft picks that Seattle has and the rising level of talent in the rest of the division.
And I had plenty of listeners coming after me on social media when I brought up this topic a few weeks ago, and they were saying, well, we had several games with 27, 28, 29 carries. It's misleading, though, because how many times do we see Russell Wilson take a snap and drop back, and then he ends up going outside of the pocket, and nobody's open, so he tucks and runs. He did that a lot last year. He had 83 carries for over 500 yards. He was very effective doing that, but those are not designed run plays. And again, the Seahawks, just looking more specifically, they only had three games in the final seven where running backs got more than 21 carries in the game. It just wasn't what we've normally seen from a Seahawks offense. You typically see them get the lead late and then they find a way to run the ball some, which skews those numbers. And even then, they still were getting pretty stark differences as far as pass plays versus run plays. And, I think Pete Carroll summed it up at the end of the season. He was talking about wanting to run the ball more next year. I think that was in retrospect, looking at how things played out last year. And really, this is what ties this discussion together, because there will be plenty of people out there that will say, okay, well, maybe we still threw the ball a lot, but there's no way we were near as aggressive on early downs. And again, that is a myth, because according to the Running Backs Don't Matter website from Ben Baldwin, it's ironic that that's the website we're using for this, but the Seahawks, when you look at neutral early down passing, so we're talking first and second downs when there's a 20 to 80% probability for a victory and excluding the final 2 minutes of each half. So we're discounting kneels and different stuff like that, but it's most of the plays that happen in a football game. The Seahawks in the first 8 weeks of the season were number one in the NFL for pass rate on first and second downs by that metric. They dropped all the way down to sixth over the last seven games. So they were still one of the top six teams for passing plays on first and second down in the NFL. So it's not like they just scrapped that. They ran the ball a little bit more on early downs, but they were still being very aggressive. So really the difference was the efficiency. Those first eight games, they were in the top six for expected points added per dropback. They were 26th in that same metric, and they were actually having negative expected points added from pass plays in the final seven games. That really sums everything up with how things changed from the first to the second half. They were still doing a lot of the same stuff. It just wasn't working. Russell was not able to create the same culinary masterpieces we saw the first 2 months of the season.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, smart guys like you, Corbin, or Ben Baldwin, Warren Sharp, all these others with their analytical websites, you know, they can give all kinds of statistics that basically just kind of bear out what those of us who maybe aren't as good with numbers but just focus in on watching some ball can also basically say the way that you just said there. Seattle didn't lose its aggressiveness. They lost their effectiveness. They just weren't nearly as efficient, as you just said, in the deep passing game. They weren't nearly as efficient in the running game. Their offense just really kind of stunk over the second half of the line of scrimmage. And I would still argue that a huge part of that would just be the struggles with durability, again, along the line of scrimmage. Even though the DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, Will Disley, all were able to play virtually the entire season, I think especially in the case of Lockett and Disley, they were shadows of themselves towards the end of the year. And that basically Seattle had to try to kind of manipulate their offense to create space for those players to get themselves open. Russell Wilson's accuracy dropped off the cliff a little bit as well. But to say that Seattle simply lost their aggression and that they did not allow Russell Wilson to cook is not accurate. He just wasn't cooking, as you said, just wasn't as effective in cooking those great culinary dishes. They were just turned a little bit kind of blah towards the end, and that was Seattle's biggest issue towards the down the stretch.
It turned into a cheap dive bar that, quite frankly, didn't have the food quality to compensate, is what really happened in the second half. And so Russell Wilson can look at a number of different things. There are a lot of things that he can be frustrated about, and it's warranted. He has had poor pass protection for most of his NFL career. As one of the top quarterbacks in the league, he should have more say in schematic issues, which they just let him help pick the offensive coordinator. So I think they've answered that to an extent. But he should be more involved in personnel decisions. A lot of the elite quarterbacks in the league are heavily involved in that stuff. He doesn't feel like he's being paid his due in that regard, but he has no ground to stand on when it comes to, I didn't have the football in my hands. You absolutely did. It just didn't work out. And again, that's not all his fault. There are other factors here. Some of these other narratives that are being thrown out, there's realism to them. This is just not one of them. They did not stop Russ from cooking, and ultimately, Pete Carroll probably wishes I would have stepped in a little more and ran the ball a little bit more. Maybe things would have played out a little bit differently with how defenses were able to scheme against them. We'll never know, but that was one of the driving forces that led to Schottenheimer being fired and them bringing in Shane Waldron. Now we just have to see if the Seahawks can make the moves necessary to make Russell Wilson happier so that he's ready to go into his first season with Waldron as the play caller. When we come back in the second quarter, it's Throwback Tuesday. We're going to look at our next draft class here. We've done 2016 and 2017. Now we're going to revisit the 2018 draft class for the Seahawks. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Football might be over, but the NBA, college basketball, and NHL are in full swing. BetOnline even covers awards, shows, and reality TV. Real-time updated odds and props and almost anything you can imagine. BetOnline has you covered for all the news, scores, and odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. This is your host, Corbin Smith. Joining me for our Tuesday show, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. We're covering everything you need to know about the Seahawks, but what about the rest of sports? Now the Locked On Podcast Network has you covered there as well with Locked On Today. It's hosted by the great Peter Bukowski, and it's all the sports news you need every morning in under 20 minutes. Subscribe to the Locked On Today podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's Throwback Tuesday. We are once again going to be revisiting one of Seattle's recent draft classes. The last 2 weeks, we've covered the 2016 draft class and the 2017 draft class. Now we're zooming forward to 2018. Typically, Rob, you can start to get a sense how good or how poor a draft class is going to be after two full seasons. You typically have a decent idea. After the third season, when you're going into the final year, these guys are going to be under contract with the exception of maybe a first rounder with a fifth year option. There's even more clarity typically. But when it comes to the Seahawks 2018 draft class, now three seasons in, I don't know that we've ever gotten that clarity because, quite frankly, a large portion of this draft class just has not been able to stay healthy long enough for us to really know whether they're capable of being impact players for the Seahawks.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when your first round selection is, of course, Rashad Penny, and he has shown some flashes, but, you know, coming off the torn ACL, having the disappointing rookie season in which he had, you know, his career didn't start off the way that the Seahawks had hoped. Usually running back is one of those positions that you can expect some immediate impact out of them. And you know, for the Seahawks, that immediate impact, it wound up being coming in the form of the former seventh round selection, Chris Carson, rather than Rashad Penny. Now with Carson, of course, as a free agent, and Seattle is kind of forced to rely a little bit on Penny and see if he is the back that they thought he was when they invested that first round selection in him. But the thing is it's not just Penny. Will Dissly being a big part of that with his struggles with durability. Rasheem Green, the second round selection, a guy that I've always thought had the tools to be a first round player, has the tools to be an every down starter in the NFL. Again, he has just scratched the surface of his potential, but is that all there's ever going to be? He's still a very young player who is still kind of growing to his body. He may wind up becoming more of a defensive tackle than a defensive end, and it is that positional versatility that to me really still stands out about him. But at the same time, we're talking about the exception of the punter Michael Dickson. We're talking about a draft class here, Corbin, that has always just kind of teased with potential, but has never really been able to prove one of John Schneider's better classes, despite the fact that most of the players are still on the team and they still do have plenty of talent that is there to pop.
Every player that was drafted by the Seahawks in that draft is still in the league, and the majority of them are still with the Seahawks. In fact, I believe the only player that isn't is Jacob Martin, and he was part of the trade to get Jadeveon Clowney. Every other player is either on a future reserve contract or they're on the 53-man roster. And so that would be a positive takeaway. Again, this all comes back to injuries because you look at those first couple players that the Seahawks picked a few years back. Rashad Penny has had his moments when he's been healthy. We saw him on the verge of breaking out during that 2019 season, and then he blew out his knee. He only got to play in three games last year. He has played in 27 games in three seasons and hasn't even gotten to 900 rushing yards. But if you go back and you watch a lot of the games he's played in, you've seen glimpses of the first-round talent that the Seahawks thought they were bringing in. His explosiveness, that third gear that he has when he's able to get to the second level of the defense, he can hit home runs. We just haven't been able to see him on the field enough for him to truly realize his potential, even come close to that. So maybe this is the year everything comes together. But he's had injuries. Rasheem Green has had injuries. He spent a good chunk of last year on injured reserve. His rookie season, he missed a bunch of games. The 1 year that he was healthy, he led the team. Granted, four sacks is still not very many, but it was a strong second season for him. You have seen flashes from him on the field where he looks like he's coming into his own and then he gets hurt or he battles inconsistency issues. And you see that with young players when they aren't able to stay on the field for a long period of time. It's tough to develop consistency when you're not out there very much. Will Dissly finally played in all 16 games last year, but his numbers were down. He looked like a shell of himself at times, coming off two severe injuries. His first two seasons before getting hurt, he looked like a Pro Bowl, maybe even an All-Pro caliber tight end. And so there have been some good picks in this draft class. Trey Flowers has started a lot of games. He has done some nice things. He's also had some stretches where he's looked like a fifth-round safety that's trying to play cornerback. But there have been flashes. Jamarco Jones has shown flashes, but he missed a full season with an ankle injury. He missed time last year with a groin injury. It all keeps coming back to injuries for most of these players. And unfortunately, if you're not on the field, it doesn't matter how talented you are. And so, again, it doesn't feel like we have a lot of clarity in this draft class, because if everybody could just stay healthy, I think you could see this group have a really strong impact on the Seahawks in 2021. But I don't know that you can necessarily count on that at this point, given the injury track records for a number of these players.
That's the thing, is I don't know that you can count on that. And with only four draft picks this year, that's what's going to make it a fascinating decision for John Schneider. Because, you know, again, with Seattle retaining Alex Collins, you know that you have Rashad Penny there. So you should, in theory, should feel good about the running back position. You have two talented backs that you believe in, that are obviously former draft picks that have shown their ability to be the bell cow when they needed to be. You've seen some flashes from DJ Dallas and Travis Homer as well. You really should have a quality running attack. But at the same time, do you feel so confident that you just ignore the position in free agency or in the draft? And the same thing, we talked about Jamarco Jones. I mean, one of the biggest areas of concern for the Seahawks is that left guard position. I've always thought that Jamarco Jones has the size, the skill set to be able to plug in and put him right there. But at the same time, because he has struggled so much with durability, can you really afford to ignore the offensive line yet again in the NFL draft? And so that's the thing. And you talked about Trey Flowers, with Seattle having the free agent concerns that they have at the cornerback position. If Trey Flowers is going to be your number one corner, well, then now we're in a whole different conversation, because you're absolutely right, Corbin. There are times where he looks like a legitimate starting corner, and other times he looks like a fifth-round pick, a former safety, essentially, playing that cornerback position. And so you have all kinds of questions about that, and you shouldn't have that 3 years into these players' NFL careers. The one thing I will say that has been true about so many of the prospects that Seattle has drafted over years is that they have had a different level of kind of resiliency. And I know that sounds kind of like I've got my blue Seahawk colored sunglasses on or whatever, but they have found young men who have gone through some serious stuff in their NFL lives, or their personal lives, I should say, before even getting to the NFL. With this being the contract year for virtually that entire class, I do expect to see a couple of these players really do have their best year this upcoming season. It's just, will it be enough for a Seahawks team that looks like it's fading fast in the NFC West?
And you mentioned players being resilient. I'll just throw a name out there that just jumped out to me, because we've talked about a number of fifth round picks. Quentin Jefferson was released early in his career and actually was on the Rams practice squad for a short while before Cliff Averill's injury forced the Seahawks to bring him back. They re-signed him, and we know that Quentin Jefferson ended up putting in a couple really nice seasons for the Seahawks as a starter at that base defensive end position, played some snaps inside as well, and he ended up turning that into a nice contract with the Buffalo Bills in free agency. So you go into this year believing it's never too late, especially with a guy like Rashad Penny, who you've seen the glimpses. You see a guy that if he can stay on the field, can be a 1,000-yard rusher. He has that kind of ability, but he just hasn't been able to stay healthy. So you're going into this year again thinking it's never too late. This year he breaks out. He's in a scheme with Shane Waldron as the coordinator that may best suit his skill set and his strengths. Rasheem Green is a guy that has flashed. LJ Collier is probably your starter there, but you could use Rasheem Green at that base defensive end spot. You could reduce him inside. There's questions about what Jaron Reed's future looks like. Maybe that means more snaps for Rasheem Green if they move on from Reed playing in the interior. Like you said, he might grow into that position. Will Disley, they're looking for tight ends, but the organization's still confident. 2 years removed from an Achilles injury, I think we'll see a more explosive Will Disley next season. So right there, I just threw out a couple of names, guys that could end up having really strong seasons for the Seahawks. And if that happens, then suddenly this draft class looks much better than it does today. There's just so many question marks with the durability aspect. And Trey Flowers has been a guy where inconsistencies marred his play. And again, he has had times he's looked like a capable starting corner, and then he'll turn around and have a few games where he looks like he's lost on Gilligan's Island and doesn't know what he's doing out there. And so the consistency issues, the durability issues have really held back this class. It feels like if they could put everything together and these guys can all play at the best level they're capable of, that this can be a very good draft class that ends up having a major impact on the Seahawks' chances of getting back to the playoffs, contending for a division title. I just don't know that you can necessarily count on this group at this point. So I've got to give it a very I'm going to go with a C minus for the grade right now, just because, yes, there's been glimpses, but I keep finding myself wanting more because these guys have just had so many injury issues. Michael Dixon's been fantastic. He's been an all-pro punter. Flowers has probably been the second best pick for them just by the fact he's been healthier and he has started a lot of games. Aside from those two, you've gotten a lot of flash in the pan, guys that have looked good and then they're out for several weeks or they're out for the rest of the season. And that has really taken the grade down several notches for a group that could be very strong for the Seahawks.
No, I absolutely agree. I think in a way it almost burns more than say like the bust that was Malik McDowell or whatever, because once you recognize what was going on there, you cut bait, you move on, but you keep giving these players more opportunities in this 2018 yeah. draft class that you're trying to allow them the opportunity to break out. And because they continue to disappoint, then you're just wasting that much more time. And so again, it's going to be really interesting to see what the Seahawks elect to do with this group of players, because some of the players that we're talking about in that particular draft class happen to be some of the biggest strengths in this upcoming year's draft class. So Seattle might be looking for replacements. They might be looking for these guys to step up. It's going to be interesting to see if any of those players are able to do exactly that.
When we come back to the third quarter, we're going to go to our second phase of the Russell Wilson trade tour. We are traveling down to New Orleans and we're going to see what Ross Jackson of Locked On Saints thinks about the possibility of Drew Brees' heir apparent being Russell Wilson. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it is now impossible to stock all the parts you need in a traditional chain storefront. Why endure often pointless or seemingly intimidating questioning and wait while the counterman orders the parts on his computer, choosing the only brand his warehouse happens to carry? You have computers with access to rockauto.com and in your pocket. RockAuto.com is a family business serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. Go to RockAuto.com to shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Best of all, prices at RockAuto.com are always reliably low, and the same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Why spend up to twice as much for the same parts? Go to RockAuto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car and truck. Write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection. Reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks, here on our Tuesday episode. For some NFL teams, the games may be over, but the work is just beginning. Join Trevor Sikma and Benjamin Solik of the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast every Tuesday as they start their Team Takeover Tuesday offseason series. Each week, they pick a new team, take a deep dive into potential front office and head coach signings, a roster review, free agent strategies, and go through a team-centric mock draft. That's every Tuesday over at Locked On NFL Draft. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast. It's time for the second segment of our Russell Wilson trade tour. Yesterday, I had a chance to catch up with Lauren Cox of Locked On Bears. We're now going down to New Orleans. Ross Jackson of the Locked On Saints podcast. Now we're going to look at another one of the four teams that apparently Russell Wilson would have interest playing for in the event that the Seattle Seahawks would be looking to trade him. Obviously, he has not demanded a trade, but we'll just start with this question, Ross. How bizarre was this to you as someone that covers another team watching this unfold where Russell Wilson's agent comes out and says he hasn't demanded a trade. He wants to play in Seattle, but then he throws out four very specific teams, including the Saints, as potential destinations that he would waive his no trade clause for.
Yeah, it was a really interesting approach, right? It's like telling a friend that's on their way out, like, hey, you don't have to like stop by the store and grab me this thing, but if you did, some mint chocolate chip ice cream would be awesome. Like, and you're like kind of hinting to that person to go off and do something. That's kind of what it feels like in terms of the bizarre nature of the request or lack thereof with all of it. But it was nuts to see all that happen. And then also to see the Saints, who, you know, really for the most part, in terms of the way that folks have looked at them as a cash strapped kind of helpless team this offseason because of the salary cap, is kind of the general outlook of the Saints this offseason. So to see them included in that was also a little surprising to me as well, just considering the general viewpoint of what the Saints offseason is expected to be, which we know isn't necessarily one to one what it actually will be.
Yeah, you know, and this is the discussion all the time. The cap, to an extent, is a mirage. But when you're right. $70 million over the cap or whatever it is the Saints currently are, then that creates a much different dynamic. And so I've been saying this all along, of the four teams that were outlined as possible destinations for Russell Wilson to go to, in 2021, the Saints seem the least likely just because of the salary cap situation. Maybe there's a way they could make it work. But let's just throw the money idea out here for a moment. And let's just pretend that every team has unlimited cash and we can pull off this deal. Let's just start off with what you think Russell Wilson would look like going to the Saints. What kind of fit would you see with him and Sean Payton's offense if this were to come to fruition, where at least the two sides were to start talking about a possible deal?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I too think that the Saints are probably the least likely to actually be able to make the move work, but the fit feels like it's its absolute best, maybe it, for the New Orleans Saints, in terms of where is the best fit for Russell Wilson. And one of the reasons why I look at that is Russell Wilson would be playing in a system that was developed for a quarterback that he modeled his passing game after, or a quarterback that he idolized in Drew Brees, somebody that he's always looked up to. The Saints offense has been one that has been sort of trying to find the right balance between having a more mobile quarterback and also having a pocket passer, somebody that can get the ball downfield as well as play close to the line of scrimmage. Obviously, the downfield part of the conversation has sort of diminished over time with Drew Brees. Father Time is undefeated, of course, but they've, you know, went to the extent so far as to want that mobility at the quarterback position that they started taking him off the field to put Taysom Hill on. In this scenario, in terms of Russell Wilson's fit, you get all of the above, all the things that you've been missing, all the things that you've been trying to create in this two quarterback switching system that they've been going with. And you give, you know, depending on what you have to give up in terms of the trade compensation, which I think is actually the harder part than the money part of the conversation, depending on what you have to give up, you put Russell Wilson in a position to where he has an Alvin Kamara, Michael Thomas, a good offensive line, or great defense over on the opposite side, and put him in a situation that he seems to be looking for, that is already in place in New Orleans and something that has remained consistent over the last 4 years.
Let's talk compensation, because as you mentioned, that really is maybe the most difficult aspect of this, because you don't see quarterbacks like Russell Wilson get moved in the prime of their career. It just doesn't happen. We're seeing what's happening in Houston right now with Deshaun Watson too. I guess you could say Carson Palmer back in the day with the Bengals ended up getting traded middle of the season to the Raiders. So that would maybe be the closest thing we've seen. This is just a much different era that we are entering now, where quarterbacks and players in general seem to be more empowered for forcing their way out, but teams still have to be able to throw the right amount of compensation at them. And all the discussions, all the reports that I've seen have been 3 first-round picks minimum to get Russell Wilson. But you took an interesting approach to this. You decided to ask your listeners what they would be throwing at the Seahawks to get Russell Wilson. And so I'm just curious what some of those proposals looked like to bring him to New Orleans.
Yeah, it felt like the untouchables for the fan base were guys like Alvin Kamara and Michael Thomas. Those seem to be the untouchable ones. But then outside of that, it's funny to watch sort of fan bases go from sort of devaluing a player while they're on the team, but then upping their value when they talk about sending them somewhere else. And all of a sudden they have, you know, enough value to maybe replace one of those 3 first-round picks. So it was a lot of trying to find the medium in between. How do we do 2 first-round picks and maybe some other supplementary picks, like a couple of seconds, couple of thirds, things like that, and then give up enough player value? Cam Jordan was a popular name, who, of course, is, you know, on the aging side, but is an edge rusher, is a pass rusher, which Seattle got a big boost from with a trade last year, being able to bring somebody in there. And then also looked at a couple of other names like Andres Pete, which is ironic, right? Giving up offensive line when you're trying to bring a player to a situation that he's trying to leave because of offensive, or not trying to leave, but he's disappointed in because of offensive line play. And then a couple of other things, like even trading Taysom Hill, which I think is a really interesting idea because there's some value in that. But does Taysom Hill give you enough to take away a first round pick? I think not. I think you still have to give 3 first-round picks, a Taysom Hill, and more in order for that to be the case. But giving a quarterback over to sort of be a bridge quarterback is helpful. The issue that I think a lot of folks don't consider is that we're not just talking about first round picks as overall value universally, we have to consider the fact that this is pick number 28. And then those are Russell Wilson led New Orleans Saints first round picks after that, which could continue to be late first round picks as well.
Yeah, that's the big sticking point here for me when I look at the Saints right now. And obviously that we can bring back the cap considerations too. And that really makes it seem far, far fetched that the New Orleans Saints would be able to do anything right now, even after June 1st. To get Russell Wilson, when you consider where their draft choice is at in the first round, the Seahawks are going to want higher first round picks. That's why maybe the Cowboys are the four teams that were listed as potential destinations would make the most sense. They've also got Dak Prescott that they can swing over. But New Orleans, you look at the cap, the compensation, it's going to be really difficult for them to put together a deal. Now, I think in 2021, if somehow this next season does not play out well, if the Seahawks don't make it deeper in the playoffs, the line doesn't play better in front of Russell Wilson, and we enter next offseason, clearly he's going to be trying to force his way out at that point. That's the way that I'm viewing this. I think the Saints in 2022, they may be primed to be able to throw an offer at the Seahawks. They can't refuse, and I think financially they would be in a better position to take that on.
Yeah, I think that that is absolutely the right idea. They could then move maybe two first round picks and then do a conditional pick in 2024, which would be a year that Russell Wilson's contract is up, a year that he's 35 years old, and then base it on player time to where that could potentially become a first round pick if the Saints make it to the playoffs, but otherwise sits as a second or a third round pick just to kind of help sweeten the pot. The way that I look at a potential trade for the Saints this year, if it were to work out in terms of compensation, would be at minimum the 2021 through 2023 first round picks. No conditional anything, no funny business. They have to be first round picks. And then a 2022 third that would be conditional could become a second on maybe 70% playing, 75% playing time, or 70% and a playoff appearance, much like what you saw with the second round pick that was moved in the future for Carson Wentz from the Indianapolis Colts. And then I'm interested in throwing Taysom Hill in there because a post June 1 transaction with Taysom Hill clears $11.5 million of salary cap space. And then you end up restructuring Russell Wilson. Once he shows up, you drop that cap hit from $19 million to about $8 million. The trade of Taysom Hill essentially helps you pay, but you have to give up another piece. So I look at somebody like Eric McCoy. You know, the Seahawks did the Saints a solid years ago, sending them Max Unger. Let me send you a future Max Unger, because the Saints have another center that they can plug in at Cesar Ruiz, who they invested a first round pick in last year.
The Saints definitely have some players on the current roster that would be intriguing if you're throwing together this trade. And I personally believe Taysom Hill would be a better option than, say, Nick Foles when you're trying to compare some of these teams that would be looking to flip a quarterback. And so at the end of the day, I think you and I would both agree that right now Russell Wilson's probably still going to be a Seahawk given the financial situation and based on the fact that he hasn't demanded a trade, even though there are four teams that he would have interest in. I think at this point, it still looks like Wilson's going to be under center for the Seahawks in 2021. But if we get to next year, and there's still plenty of discontent there, the Saints might be a prime target, a prime landing spot for Wilson. We'll just have to wait and see. Thanks for jumping on, Ross. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Looking forward to next time we get to talk about a potential Russell Wilson to New Orleans trade.
I don't know if I'm looking forward to that topic, actually, but I'm looking forward to the next time that we have a chance to chat. As always, greatly appreciate it. You can follow me on Twitter at Corbin Smith NFL. You can follow Ross at Ross Jackson NOLA, N-O-L-A. That's Ross Jackson, N-O-L-A. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your preferred podcast platform is, by visiting our website, LockedOnSeahawks.com. When we return on Wednesday, Rob Rang and I will be looking at some underrated free agent options the Seahawks may consider on offense and defense. Plus, we'll be continuing our Russell Wilson trade tour with a visit from Locked On Raiders. You won't want to miss it. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Go Hawks.